morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Christina Solem, and I'm here on behalf of Elmer Wagner, the appellant and cross-respondent. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
As an initial matter, the respondent has failed to assign error to findings of fact as required by Rob 10.3G, and we just ask that any unchallenged findings of fact be treated as verities on appeal. The first issue in this case is whether the respondent, Ms. Archer's cross-claims for the unauthorized practice of law and
undue influence.
Thank you, undue influence. Constitute a will contest within the meaning of RCW 1124.010. That statute says...
Why does it matter?
I'm sorry?
Why does it matter you prevail?
It matters because for the next issue, which is the application of the disinheritance clause.
But didn't she do so on the advice of counsel?
She did. And if...
Doesn't that eviscerate the bad faith claim you're making to trigger the no contest clause?
In the estate of Mumby, the court held that the advice of counsel only addresses the presumption of whether the petitioner acted within good faith and with probable cause. The court in that case addressed that issue and then went on to address whether the petitioner acted with good faith and probable cause. Bad faith, the Mumby court defined, is actual or constructive fraud or neglect not prompted by an honest mistake as to one's rights or duties, but by some interested or sinister motive. In this case, the untimeliness of the will contest, the absolute lack of evidence to support any of these claims, demonstrates that there is no good cause for this, regardless of the advice of counsel. Ms. Archer brought this will contest 3 years after the will had been admitted to probate. She had already admitted to the court that the will was valid and not the product of undue influence as part of her petition to be admitted as personal representative and have the will submitted to probate. She offered no evidence that Mr. Wagner engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. The only testimony was that Mr. Wagner acted as a scrivener for his wife. There was no testimony offered to the contrary. There was also no evidence that Ms. Archer or Ms. Wagner, the decedent, was incompetent, that she'd been isolated from her family. She was able to drive herself places at the time she drafted the will, and she did this 10 or 11 months before she passed away. All evidence, strongly and without contradiction, pointed in favor of a valid will made by a competent testator with no undue influence and no unauthorized practice of law. And we spent a considerable amount of time at the trial court level on this issue and, again, on appeal. Ms. Archer should not be allowed to hide behind the advice of counsel on this issue, especially to the extent it has substantially prejudiced Mr. Wagner. This has been a costly and time-consuming case, and the actions that we're complaining of her continued breaches aren't an isolated incident. This is part of a long-running pattern to deny Mr. Wagner his inheritance. We also ask that this court find that the trial court abused its discretion in not removing her. Ms. Archer has hidden behind her counsel throughout this case, arguing that her breaches should be excused because of her attorneys. She blamed her first attorney for the fact that she didn't investigate Mr. Wagner's equitable lien claim, for mischaracterizing non-probate assets, for refusing to properly allocate and distribute the proceeds from the sale of the home.
So what is the problem now? I mean, so you feel that the court should have done that, but isn't it over, basically?
I'm sorry?
Isn't the case over? I mean, I guess the problem that I'm having here is that what's going to change if
to the extent that
if your appeal is accepted and we rule in your favor and do what, send it back for adjustment of a $5,000 error?
What remains to be done is that the oil and mineral deeds are an ongoing distribution and will be for the duration of Mr. Wagner's life. And given the contentiousness in this case, we've asked that there be an independent personal representative so that we're not back in front of the court in a few years. If something happens again, there's someone who has no interest in.
Well, there isn't any evidence that Archer has failed to follow the court's directions. The evidence is that she's followed her attorney's directions and that they've been misguided.
She has certainly made that argument. There is no evidence that she hasn't followed the court's orders that I'm aware of. But to the extent that this is a repeated, repetitive, long-running course of conduct.
If you look at her testimony, counsel keeps asking her questions about disbursements, for instance. She goes, I don't know. If my attorney did that, I'm not aware. I don't know. It certainly, nothing that was brought out at trial suggests that she's a mastermind directing her attorney to twist your client into the ground.
She also did not ask her attorney any questions. If her testimony also included statements that she didn't follow up or she didn't check. She just left it to her attorney. And Ms. Archer resides in Illinois, which might be part of the problem in this case. So she is not an in-state personal representative actively watching over this.
The statute allows you to appoint an in-state agent. That's not a defect. And it doesn't require a personal representative to be particularly bright or knowledgeable about the law. What did
just
she
to
do
answer
wrong?
Briefly, I agree that that's what the statute requires. I would say given the evidence we've seen here and how this estate has been managed, Ms. Archer is not a suitable personal representative going forward, given her prior conduct. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Jay Mills. I'm here for Ms. Archer. When I was a really young lawyer, early on, I got involved in this case that involved a check, and it was made to Mr. Smith / Mr. Jones. And we were all asking ourselves, what the heck does that mean? You know, did it require two signatures or just one? That case went through the Court of Appeals. It's an interesting case, but the learning experience from that case and many others is that people do the darndest things, and then lawyers get involved and courts get involved in trying to make some sense of what they did. And that's certainly going on in this case. There is a deed in this case, and it's made pay. It's a deed that grants property to Liz Wagner or Jill Archer. And I confess I have no idea what the heck that means or what people were trying to do there. I've talked to many lawyers about what they think it means, and uniformly lawyers throw up their hands. The court interpreted that to be to Liz if she's alive. Otherwise, to Jill, and I don't know how the court reached that conclusion. It's an illogical conclusion because at the time the deed was given, it's crystal clear that Liz was alive, and she lived long after the deed. I think the court, going down that path, could just as easily have said.
You haven't cited any authority that says it was an error of law to go that way, and. Nor even explained how it's an abuse of discretion to go that way.
I think it is an error of law. Let me get to that. And I think that was in the brief.
Sooner
I might
than
have
later.
Missed it. I might not have been very clear. Let me say that there are a number of ways that could have been interpreted. And that's one. By the way, one not sort of discussed in any of the briefing is it may have been an inartful way to create a joint tenancy. That is, it might have been an inartful way to deed the property such that whoever survived as to Jill or Liz would get the property entirely. That would then be not a tenancy in common where they would have an indivisible interest. But I think that instead of trying to go around and sort of read something into it that isn't there, that the answer to to the consequence of that will is described by the statute. Because the statute, which I cited in the brief, says that if you want to create a joint tenancy, that is an arrangement whereby the survivor gets everything, then you have to be very specific about that. So otherwise, what you have when multiple parties are identified on a deed is a tenancy in common. That is, they have an undivided interest, which can be willed away or sold. You may have to go out and partition it in court to get it done. But it creates a tenancy in common. And I think what the court should have done is to say, as confusing as this deed is, it creates, under the law, by application of the statute, it creates a tenancy in common. That is, Jill, there's some reason that Jill's name appears on that deed. And what the court did was simply interpret the deed as if her name wasn't even on it. I think that's an error. I think it's an error of law, because I think the authority is the statute on deeds, which says you can create a joint tenancy.
But one of the elements of joint tenancy is unity of title, and or, unlike and, does not suggest unity of title.
Correct. And I guess what I'm saying is that the statute deals with multiple people listed on the deed, and it doesn't segregate or talk about how those people are connected. In other words, I think you could just list names independently. I think you could put ampersands in it. You could put slashes. You could put ors or ands or whatever. What the statute is saying is we recognize when you're conveying property to multiple people that there's two choices there, joint tenancy or tenancy in common. And because this is not clearly a joint tenancy, because whatever was written on that deed does not clearly create a joint tenancy, under the statute it creates, by operation of law, a tenancy in common. Now, the judge didn't say that. The judge simply wrote Jill off the deed as if she didn't exist. And I think that's an error, because if you apply the statute correctly, you get a tenancy in common. And this case should be, at the very least, this case should be remanded with instructions to make the division as if the deed creates tenants in common. And so that's part of what I think is interesting about this, that we have this.
Let me ask you a question about the equitable lien. You've argued that it was inappropriate to value the equitable lien without an offset for the rental value of the property. I couldn't find in the record where you put on any evidence of the rental value of the property.
If that's not cited out clearly in the briefing, I'm going to have to get it for you. The testimony was pretty uncontroverted that property was, for a period of time, rented, and for a period of time, Elmer and Liz lived in it. And I think there's some fuzziness to exactly what periods they were living in it and what periods they had it rented. But during the periods that they're living in it, then the community, the Liz and Elmer community, are getting free rent. They're not paying rent to Liz, who is
the separate. Court's not required to speculate as to what the value of that rent is in order to offset. You have an obligation to present evidence. The court can make an order within. Well, I'm looking for the evidence.
Well, it was rented for a period of time, and I think the amount, the monthly rental amount, is in fact there.
But that would apply to that period of time. You've got a long period of time that you were.
Yeah, but let me just say that I think that flips the burden. In other words, I don't think that there's some presumption for an equitable lien. The presumption is that separate property remains separate property, and a community property remains community property. It's true that an equitable lien can be imposed if the party asking for the equitable lien makes it showing. But when the evidence shows that they were renting it and they were living there, I think you immediately say, what equitable lien comes out of that? Because you got value out of the property. I know that they were paying the mortgage. That's true. But during the period that they were paying the mortgage, they were either living there or renting it out. So because the burden is on the party asserting an equitable lien, I think that it's an error to provide it when the uncontroverted evidence is that either they're living there or they're renting it out. So I think that's a problem. I would say that this, in connection with my original thoughts about confusing things that people do, this will is horribly confusing. If you look at page 1, it says that all of what Liz owned before the marriage would go to her kids, and that that was part of a longstanding agreement. On page two, though, she starts giving away things that she owned before the marriage.
Which was now, true of the predecessor will as well.
In part, yes. And then, of course, Elmer got even more under the new one. But the point is that the judge interpreted this to say, let's pretend page one doesn't exist. I think one could as easily have said, let's pretend page two doesn't exist. Now, I understand there's a problem there. The judge has to do something. But here's my point. I think this is exactly why this case should be decided on the basis that Elmer shouldn't have been involved in making that will. If he's going to take big chunks that are inconsistent with page one, he has to not be a participant. He should have sent her to a lawyer. Had he sent her to a lawyer, these problems probably would not exist. And so that's why I think what you should do here is remand it with instructions to deny the petition. And by the way, that gets a little bit to this issue of a will contest. I'm not trying to say invalidate the will, because, for example, Elmer lived in that house under the will. It didn't go to the kids. He had a life estate until he moved out. I'm not saying the court should somehow invalidate the will and make him pay some fair value for that. He got substantial pre-petition distributions. I'm not asking the court to make him return those, to invalidate the will and give him nothing. But I do think that it should be remanded with instructions to deny the petition, which is to say that we're not going to be, as the court, participating in allowing Elmer to get more of what he shouldn't have gotten by participating in practicing law without a license. And at the least, to remand with instructions to give Jill her fair share of the property and affirm in all respects. Thanks for your time.
Just to address the issue of reforming the distributions to Mr. Wagner, that's will contest. However you strike it, Ms. Archer is asking that this court change the terms of the distribution set forth in the will. The Botcher case, 45-1-2-579, says that you're dealing with will contest when you are raising claims intended to break the term of a will. That's what's being asked here. As to the deed, we ask that this court affirm the trial court's ruling on this issue. Unchallenged finding of fact 1.28 says that Ms. Archer never took delivery of the deed. As this court has noticed, this deed says to A or B.
Yeah, there's only one deed.
Correct.
Now, if there's a deed and it had said and, one person would have physically taken delivery, but both would have taken possession and title.
Correct. This was not, there's
drawing a legal conclusion, not the fact of physical delivery.
And the evidence supports that if it is treated as a legal conclusion, and the law supports it as well. Washington courts have consistently held that absent intent to the contrary, or is a disjunctive term, and here there's no evidence that the grantor intended to grant to Ms. Archer and Ms. Wagner. There is the use of the word or. There's the delivery to a single grantor. Ms. Archer wasn't even informed of this deed or her name on it until much later. It's not like the grantor called her and said, I'm giving this property to you and your mom. Ms. Archer did not institute a quiet title action at any point during her supposed ownership or even after the decedent passed away. She didn't try to collect rent. She did nothing that would indicate she believed that she was an owner of this property. Ms. Archer should also be found to be stopped from denying that she has a larger share of this estate or this property than anyone else. In her petition to admit the will, she admitted that she and her brothers had an equal one-third interest in the property subject to Mr. Wagner's life estate. That's Clerk's Papers, page 2. Based on this and other representations, Ms. Archer was appointed personal representative. We would ask that this court not allow her to change her position midstream and affirm the trial court's finding that this property was titled are held by Ms. Wagner prior to her death. We also ask that this court uphold the trial court's finding that there was no equitable offset required. That is an abuse of discretion standard for the trial court. In the briefing, Ms. Archer relies on Miracle versus Miracle. In that case, the court held that the court, quote, may offset an equitable lien with rents not paid, but it's not required. This case is further distinguishable from Miracle in that considerable improvements were made to the home out of the community funds, and it is uncontested that those are community funds.
Well, if the mortgage payments were offset by the use, then all you'd have is a lien for the improvements.
We have a lien for the improvement. It's unchallenged, though, that the mortgage payments came out of the joint accounts into which Mr. Wagner put his separate property.
Would you take a moment and comment on the claim about the erroneous payment out of the registry?
The allocation?
Yes.
Okay, so
why isn't the accountant's breakdown correct?
Sure. So our position is that the allocation for payments to Mr. Wagner out of the registry should be made separate, should be made in advance of any distributions. Basically, the way the last distribution was done, Mr. Wagner funds a piece of the distribution to himself. If there's, for easy math purposes, $10,000 in the registry and Mr. Wagner's entitled to a quarter to make him whole and then a quarter of the rest.
But before he's entitled to a quarter, don't all the estate expenses have to be offset against all the estate assets?
They do. Mr. Wagner's distributions shouldn't be, in our opinion, should not be considered an estate expense. If these distributions had been made properly from the beginning, Mr. Wagner would not be required to lose that portion of his distribution. And that's what these payments to him are. They're make-whole payments intended to account for prior misallocations of the distributions.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be at recess.
Court is in recess.